This evening I'm going to talk a little bit about a very important concept in our Buddhist tradition, in Buddhism in general. It's called in Pali, Papancha, and in Sanskrit, Prapancha. Before I tell you what it is, I will maybe try to give you an analogy. Imagine there were cars and roads and traffic like there is now, and you were a driver and driving these cars around, but there were no stop signs and no traffic lights at all. So driving would be more interesting because no one would have to stop. No one would have to stop, or everyone else has to stop, but you don't have to stop. And so, you know, just kind of drive freely, just go along. And it would be quite a mess. But luckily, there are stop signs and there are traffic lights, which certainly keeps things orderly. But what it requires us to do is we stop and we wait and notice the traffic, and when it's our turn, we go. So in a similar kind of way, if our minds are, if our thinking minds are like the cars, then all too often our minds travel routes that have no stop signs and no traffic lights. And off they go, and it can be quite a mess. Someone once said that the epitome of the human mind is a traffic jam of discursive thought. So sometimes it can be quite... And someone else had an analogy of the mind is kind of like you have an off-ramp on a freeway, but that off-ramp takes you right back on again. So it's possible to get into a lot of trouble with our thinking mind and having a thinking going on and on and on. And if there's no realistic stops or pauses to kind of look around, see what the other traffic is, notice what's going on, give the opportunity for certain things to move ahead because they have the right of way or whatever, it's possible to get the mind overheated or overexcited or over anxious or overly depressed or weighed down by the thoughts that it has. And so traffic, you know, traffic stops are good. And so mindfulness, in a sense, or meditation, can be seen, and one of its functions is it's a healthy traffic stop. You know, it's a stop. Stop and look. Let's notice what's going on. And so you're not giving free rein for the mind to do whatever it wants. Now, of course, reality is often interfering with the free course of the mind. And that's lucky for most of us, because if we gave absolutely free control of our mind to do whatever it wanted, most of us would probably start going a little bit crazy. But, you know, we have to bump into things. Doors have to be opened to notice them, and all kinds of things have to happen. And so we have to be interrupted, and so we kind of have to pay a little bit of attention to ourselves and our surroundings. But it's possible to live life quite actively also, very engaged in many ways, and still let the course of the mind move on and on and on in perpetuity and kind of endless cycles. In fact, what Buddhism says is or suggests is that our preoccupation with thoughts, with thinking, is part of the fuel that perpetuates the thinking. So it's kind of like a self-perpetuating motion machine. You've been looking one for a long time, and there it is in your own mind. And so we get caught up in our thoughts, and we get triggered by our thoughts, and we make associations with our thoughts. We react to our thoughts with further thoughts, more thinking. And this process of thinking is a useful process if we have the proper way of handling it, if we have the proper stop signs and stop lights and rear view mirrors and ways of really seeing what's going on. But, you know, you can have too much of a good thing. So another maybe analogy would be, you know, you got into a car one day and they wouldn't let you out. You have to always be driving. And fortunately, they have these full-service gas stations. So You don't have to get out of your car to put gas in. He's getting, you know, and in fact they have drive-in, you know, restaurants. You can get your food, and they put it right through your side window. And they, in this kind of world, of course, the full-service gas stations also help you with your bathroom, so you don't have to leave your car. And so you're always in your car. You know, you're always driving your car, and you're going. And you know, after a while, you know, this really great thing, the car, is not so great anymore. You know, you kind of beg to get out. It's hard for people to see how they're often stuck or caught in the elaborations, proliferations, the mental preoccupations of the mind, and to see that there's an alternative. Because it's kind of like it's supposed to be like the fish that can't see the water it swims in, supposedly. So sometimes it's very hard to see the world of thinking that we're living in, partly because there's a camouflage effect of thinking sometimes. And that is, we're thinking about something. So the mind is concerned with the thing that we're thinking about, not the process of thinking, not the event of thinking. It's so important what we think about. And one of the very interesting questions in a mindful life is, why does our attention, why does our thinking fixate on particular things? Why do we follow after certain desires or certain aversions? Why do we get preoccupied by certain things? Why does the mind go down certain channels, certain roads in a thought? Why does it do that? And part of, I think, a mindful life is to begin investigating that. You know, what are the common routes that I take in my mind? And why do I do that? Why is that so interesting? Why is the mind so motivated to always be thinking about such a thing? You know, if you have common themes. Or if you have never have any common themes at all, whatsoever, and your mind is completely just kind of a fog that kind of, you never really quite know what you're thinking about, but you know you're thinking somewhat vaguely, but there's no particular theme, that's very interesting in itself. So that's warrants investigation. What's going on there? And so part of the mindful life is to look at what's going on with our thinking mind. Now this word papancha that I wanted to teach you is means, it's sometimes translated as proliferation of thinking. Or it also translated sometimes as elaborations of thinking. And it's this proliferating movement of thought that starts leaving reality into abstractions. So if I see a bell here, there's a recognition, this is a bell, this is IMC's bell. That's a simple moment of thought, simple thinking. And that has some basis in reality. You know, it's used here at IMC, and called it IMC's bell. And we're very happy with it. But then a proliferation would be, it makes a really nice sound. It really helped my meditation when they rang it. I think that my meditation at home would be improved a lot if I had this kind of bell. I wonder if there's some way that I could borrow it, or buy it, or steal it. And, you know, after all, you know, these Buddhists are supposed to be quite detached. You know, they're not really so attached to the things. You know, they probably don't care if I, you know, take it. I wouldn't really steal it, because you can't steal from someone who's detached. And so I'm sure it's quite ethical. And you know, and I'm sure I can use it much better than, you know, what happens here. And so the mind kind of moves on. But, you know, that's, you know, kind of funny. But then it moves on from there and says, "And oh, no, I shouldn't be thinking that way. That's not proper. Maybe I should need to look at this more carefully. I think therapy is right for me. But therapy, I can't really afford therapy. And because I can't really, you know, I just don't have the right job. And, you know, the job's not making enough money. And after all, that boss of mine just not treating me well. In fact, my boss never treats me well. And that boss of mine reminds me of my, you know, teacher in high school who really kind of was on my case, and I was not teacher's pet, and all those teachers of mine, those teachers, education is really bad in this country. and this is just a preface. You know, and off it goes, right? And it all started because of the bell. It was, right? That's where it all began. So that's called proliferation of thinking, or abstractions. And this is when the traffic doesn't have any stop signs. And what we can do with mindfulness is we can notice, oh, here goes the mind. We can notice that the horse is starting to speed up. And wait a minute, do I really want to take that route? Do I want to travel down that way? Is this really useful for me? And so you can have a little check Is this really what I want to do with my mind? And I suspect that a lot of people can live a whole lifetime without asking themselves the question, is this what I should be doing with my mind, with my thinking? And so it's possible to check that. And even if you can't stop what you're thinking, sometimes it's very helpful to realize, oh, this is what I'm thinking about. To see it. Oh, thinking is going on. This is what my mind is concerned about, preoccupied about. Can be sometimes very helpful to see that. Some people use extreme measures to stop. So this proliferation has a momentum. It's not just simply empty words, you know, in the sky of the mind that pass through. But it's energy behind thinking. There's a lot of thinking and preoccupation. There's energy, there's momentum, there's tension, there's emotions connected to it. And that momentum is sometimes, you can't just stop it like that. And because the momentum has been set in motion. I've noticed sometimes when I'm really involved in some kind of mental process or even something involved in cleaning house at home, that after an hour of cleaning house, it's time to stop. But there's a little momentum to clean sometimes. And, oh, what else needs to be cleaned? Or if I'm thinking about something, you know, I stop thinking about it and then my mind still goes there more frequently because the momentum is still there. And so how do you stop the momentum? And I saw a movie many years ago. It was kind of a documentary, short documentary, of a man who said, it was about his hobby, what he did for a kind of a sport. He said, I used to race motorcycles. But then I had a family with kids, and it wasn't really appropriate. It was too expensive, took a lot of time, and maybe it was dangerous or something. So it wasn't really appropriate to ride motorcycles anymore, race the motorcycles. So I didn't have much time, so I had to figure out something else. So what he figured out, and because what he did was the motorcycle racing helped clear his mind. So that's an expression we use, right? When we have too big of a traffic jam in there, we try to clear our mind. And so he had to figure out a different clearing than motorcycle racing. And what he figured out to do, which is a sport, I don't know what it's called, maybe some of you know this name, but it's kind of like, not hang gliding, but I guess parachuting off skyscrapers. And then this documentary showed him he had to sneak onto these construction sites where they're building skyscrapers we can get in, right? And it's open. What?
That's a lot safer.
A lot safer. And so he would get in there just before dusk, you know, because, so he could be up at the very top, you know, at dawn before the workers got there. And he'd have a getaway car friend in the streets. And then he would jump. And then at the right moment, he would release the parachute and he'd glide down to the street and pack it all up and get in the car and run off. And by the time he did all that, his mind was clear. So, you know, there are some, you might think that there are more efficient ways than meditating. But meditation is also meant to be a place to kind of not only to see this momentum, to be able to take stock and understand what's going on, but also to begin clearing the mind, learning how to have the mind not chase after the thoughts, not react to thoughts, leave the thoughts alone, or drop them, stop them. If you can't stop them, then leave them alone. If you can't stop them, don't believe them. If you can't stop them, don't react to them. Just let them be. Many years ago, I was at Tassajara Zen Monastery, and one of the teachers there described why he got involved in Zen practice. He said he got involved in Zen practice because he was really troubled by his thinking, and he wanted to kind of somehow come to terms with it. And so he did, you know, some years of Zen practice and Zen training. And what he learned was his thinking didn't stop, but he stopped being bothered by it. And that was the big transformation for him. He no longer was bothered by it. And in fact, that's what Suzuki Roshi, the Zen teacher in San Francisco, his instructions around thinking was, don't be bothered by it. Don't bother it, and don't be bothered by it. Which is another way of saying, don't get caught in its web. Don't get caught in the stickiness of the thoughts and the concerns. Why do we think it's so important to think? Those of you who think. Why is it so important? What great solutions? What great pleasures? What great protection are you going to get from your thinking? Why rehearse conversations you've had, you know, hundreds of times in your head? Rehearse conversations from the past. Why spend endless time planning a future you don't know is going to arrive? Why spend a lot of time in fantasy? All kinds of fantasies people's mind goes into. Why is it doing that? What's the benefit of all these activities? What benefit are you getting from it? And one of the things that we're hoping to discover through something like meditation practice is that there's something which is more beneficial for us than staying involved in the world of thinking, the world of prapancha, this proliferation, this abstraction, this world we can get into. It can be more beneficial for us to be involved in something else besides thinking. And this is a difficult lesson for the poor mind to learn, the thinking mind to learn. And sometimes the thinking mind will protest because that's all it knows is it's the world of thinking. It's just, that's the name of the game for some people. But can it be more beneficial to engage the mind in something different than thinking? For some minds, it's an inconceivable idea because, you know, what else is there? I mean, that's just what the mind does. It just kind of secretes thoughts all the time. And, you know, is there something else to do? But of course there is. And then a simple example would be some people really like to listen to music. And I would argue that to be able to listen to music is not dependent on thinking about the music. In fact, thinking about the music might prevent you from really taking in the aesthetic feeling and sense, the emotion of listening to the music. Listening to the music is not a thought-filled activity. It's a sensory activity. It maybe involves all kinds of capacities besides just hearing, but it doesn't have to involve a lot of thinking. In fact, I remember once I went to a symphony, and I had to spend the first half of the symphony before an intermission listening to the music with my eyes closed, because with my eyes open I was thinking too much about what I was seeing, you know, about what I was seeing in the orchestra and everything, you know, and it was just detracting from the music, so I closed my eyes so I wouldn't think so much. And then after the intermission I was settled enough, I'd calmed down enough that my mind didn't think that way anymore, and so I could listen with my eyes open. So certain aesthetic things don't require a lot of thinking. And so that's one example of something that can be very beneficial, very nice, that doesn't involve thinking. And you can probably think of other things that are this similar. So meditation allows us to start tuning into some peace, some stillness, some capacity for sensory awareness, some sense of inner well-being, some other kind of way of connecting to ourselves that's different than connecting to ourselves or connecting to the world through our thinking. The opposite of papancha is in Pali is nir papancha. Nir here means N-I-R means without or not. So without papancha, or absence of papancha, absence of this elaboration. And the Buddha praised this absence very highly because he considered it to be a synonym with freedom, with liberation. So to be able to stop the abstractions of the mind, the elaborations of the mind, in order to be present for this life in a much more simple, direct way. Now, elaborations, papancha, is not the same thing as a simple thought of recognition, a simple kind of, you know, recognition of what's happening here and now. So you don't have to stop thinking entirely, but to stop thinking this, you know, endless proliferation of abstraction is a very important quality. So when you're thinking, when you notice yourself thinking, is your thinking about something which is actual here and now? Or is it about something which is here, is, you know, there and now, or there and then? Is it about some other time and place? Is it some abstraction, or is it something here concrete? What would happen to you if you let go of the abstraction, what's not really actual, let go of the virtual world where the thoughts can take you, and begin being very simple for your direct experience here and now? And is it to your benefit to do that? It doesn't mean you have to do it all the time. You don't have to give up your cars. You just have to stop at the stop signs. And sometimes park and do something else. But But so sometimes it's beautiful to be involved in the elaborations of the mind, the abstractions. It's an important part of human life. But it's also phenomenally beautiful to be able to put it down, to stop it, and then to connect this life in a much more simple and much more direct way, with a simplicity of presence, with a simplicity of presence that you know, just here we are. As maybe some of you know, one of the techniques for people who have panic attacks is to ask them to look around the room they're in and say, and identify, is there any threat in the room here? Is the room safe? You know, you're in a therapist's office or something. You know, there's a flower on the table, and you know, that looks safe. And somehow to look around. And that does two things. One, it a little bit distracts the person from the proliferation of thoughts, which sometimes trigger the panic. But also, it shows them in the concrete, actual world here, there is no danger. And that can, some people can be very helpful to settle them, because in the concrete world can be very simple. The concrete, immediately world, sometimes is not very promising in relationship to the great promise that our abstract desires can have. And that's part of the reason why we want to stay in our thoughts, because we have this great goal in the future. But I think one of the hopefully opportunities of meditation practice is to show a sense of well-being or delight or joy or satisfaction or peace that is possible when the mind is not driven by its preoccupations. And to discover slowly that joy can be one of the greatest joys of human life. It's not going to look good on your resume. It's not going to look good in your bank account. It's not going to look good, you know, in many kind of worldly kind of criteria, the fact that you know how to sit still and be happy. In fact, someone told me, I don't know if it's true, a woman from Thailand once said that the Thai government tried to make a law preventing Buddhist teachers in Thailand from giving teachings on contentment. Because if the population is content, then the economy is not going to be driven and grow, and you know, industry is not going to develop. You need to have discontented people to kind of, you know, want more. Have a big, you know. I guess the Super Bowl is the important time for commercials in America. I think we can buy, IMC can buy a commercial. You know, 30 seconds. Don't buy anything. The most valuable thing you can have in life is found by not buying it. Don't buy. Stop. You can do it. And of course, we have a very wonderful pastoral scene with a young woman, young man doing nothing. You know, they wouldn't even be seductive. They'd be doing nothing. And we might win some kind of Super Bowl award for best commercial. And then there'd be a law. No more commercials like that in the United States. It's too subversive. When I was a Zen student, this was one of my favorite poems. It's a poem by Ryokan. And I'll read it to you twice. I'll read it to you once. And then afterwards, I'll tell you a little bit about the context for the poem, and then read it again. With no mind, blossoms invite the butterfly. With no mind, the butterfly visits the blossoms. When the flower blooms, the butterfly comes. When the butterfly comes, the flower blooms. I do not know others. Others do not know me. Not knowing each other, we naturally follow the way. So you might think that a mind that's clear, a mind which is not driven or caught in the world of papancha, maybe it's not a safe mind. Maybe it's a mind that's not going to get any wonderful things. In order to get the wonderful things of life, you have to plan and think and imagine and all these wonderful things. Like now this idea of imagining what you want. Is that what they say? Imagining what you want, and if you imagine it right, it'll come your way. And that's papancha. So no mind, this mind is not caught up in elaborations. And that no mind, that simple mind, perhaps you don't have to figure out what you're going to say next. Perhaps you don't have to figure out what you're going to do next. Perhaps there can be a natural thing that comes next out of that, out of you. You can trust your innate intelligence to know what to do. Why don't you trust your innate intelligence? Why do you plan and worry and concern before you do something? What would happen if you didn't plan, just let something come out? When I was writing my dissertation, one of the few wonderful things that happened writing a dissertation was a discovery that I didn't have to know the end of the sentence when I began it. And that was really freeing for me. You know, I wasn't so kind of wrapped up in my words and my thoughts and ideas. It was a process of discovery. Writing was a process of discovery. I discover what I thought, in a sense, in that process. So with no mind, things happen. With no mind, blossoms invite the butterfly. With no mind, butterflies visit the blossom. Not knowing each other, we naturally follow the way. So there's something about the beginner's mind, the not knowing mind. I'm not knowing so much. Clearing the mind and seeing something fresh and new, not seeing it with the old way of knowing. And then, in this sense, not knowing someone else, allowing them to be fresh and new, not someone you've seen every morning for 30 years as if you know who they are. But who's this person? Who's this person today? Don't know the other person. So that's the kind of not knowing. And not knowing each other, we naturally follow the way. That's my commentary. Now, this poem by Ryokan has a little story behind it. And that is, it's a love poem. It was written when he was quite old. And we don't know, no one really knows exactly what the relationship was, but he had with this young nun who would come visit him in his hut, I guess. Or, you know, they had some kind of very close relationship. And so they wrote these poems, friendship poems or love poems, back and forth. And this was his poem to her. With no mind, blossoms invite the butterfly. With no mind, the butterfly visits the blossoms. When the flower blooms, the butterfly comes. When the butterfly comes, the flower blooms. I do not know others. Others do not know me. Not knowing each other, we naturally follow the way. That's an interesting way of being in relationship. So, I have elaborated and abstracted and proliferated enough this evening. So now it's your turn to do likewise or say, ask questions or anything you'd like, please.
If you're sitting in meditation and your mind is just going haywire, you know, bombarded with thoughts, and maybe it's causing some anxiety, should you meditate through it or should you actually stop?
I think that the it's hard to answer that question in simple, the one answer, because. The answer, your answer is found through trial and error, hopefully. So you have a trial and error, you kind of experiment and see what works and what doesn't work. Sometimes one of the best things you can do when your mind is bombarded with thoughts and you're very anxious is sit and meditate. And to learn the skill, learn the ability to be present for all the energy, all the stuff that's going on, and learn how to step away from it a little bit so it doesn't get fueled, and then let it kind of settle by itself in its own way. And meditation can be a great help for some people. Sometimes, however, anxious thinking, and if you pay attention to it, it makes us more anxious. And so it can be counterindicated because you can kind of spin out even more and more and more. And so maybe then it's not useful to meditate if that's that's the result of trying to meditate. So if it's not working, if it's getting worse because of the, you know, when you sit and meditate, then you can do, you know, one thing you can do is come and talk to a teacher. And maybe there's some techniques or some way of meditating that can be helpful. The other thing is maybe that's not the time to meditate. Maybe there's other things that are more useful for you. It could be going for a run. It will clear your mind more. Or taking a long shower, or, talking with a friend. You know, there's a variety of other things that might settle it. So you have to kind of be able to do it through trial and error and through the intelligence you have. Try to have a sense, you know, what's the right strategy here, given what's going on. In different days, there might be different strategies. And what's important about trial and error is we learn by error as much as we do by success. And I think that a hallmark of this practice of mindfulness is has that quality of trial and error. We're learning through engaging and trying to learn and trying to do something. And oh, that didn't quite work. Let's try a different way or something like that. Does it make sense? And if you're unsure in this circumstance, then don't meditate. You know, if it's getting worse, or, you know, just then do something that else that you might know might be helpful.
You gave a very good analogy on this traffic. There was a time when there were no lights, there were no stop signs, and still the traffic moved. I used to live in Africa where there was nothing like stop light, nothing like stop sign. Still we were able to drive because the life was simple. Do you think the simplicity has to do a lot with this proliferation of thoughts? Simplicity. If we are simple, will our mind have lots and lots of the word you use, sometimes I cannot... Proliferation.
Prapancha.
Yeah, yes. Prapancha, I can pronounce it better. Do you think the simplicity can reduce the agony of...
I think a lot of people find that a simpler lifestyle reduces the anxiety, the proliferation, the fastness of their mind, their life, what's going on in their thinking. And I know some people have chosen to move to environments where things are slower because of that. And there's a kind of way in which it's contagious in this environment. There's so much going on, so many things to do, and people feel like they have to always be busy and doing and filling. And so, yes, it can be very helpful to go and live in a place where things are really simple and quiet. But it's no guarantee. You might be lucky, and you might bring everything with you. And see, like I've gone to really simple places, like Buddhist monasteries, and I've been with a lot of other people who've gone to Buddhist monasteries, and it's amazing how much people bring with them. How much people bring with them. So they think they're leaving behind, you know, their suffering, leaving behind all the difficulties, and it comes along with them. But that's an environment, because it's a simpler environment. It allows people to see it much more clearly. So I remember the Buddha had all his teachings about prapancha, in a time and a culture 2,500 years ago when there was no cars. You know, things were a lot simpler, but it's still easily possible. And in fact, the Buddha, he gave this elaboration, this proliferation of abstract thinking as being one of the sources, one of the causes in the chain of causes of that leads to violence. And that was 2,500 years ago.
Thank you very much. One of the things I've always had great difficulty with is actually in the process of mindfulness, watching my thoughts. By definition, my thoughts for me are always, they're already come and gone. And they're already past tense, and I've been here and there. By the time I realize that I have been thinking, and I have trouble, you know, the analogy of sort of watching clouds go by is the analogy of understood of watching thoughts, and I don't know how to
do that.
How to stay present to watch thoughts.
So you're not having the experience of the thoughts passing through?
I can't do it in the present tense. It's really difficult. It's always after the fact.
It's an interesting phenomenon, so it might be interesting for you somehow to explore that yourself, kind of get a sense of the overall ecology of what's happening when you start looking at thoughts. There could be a very subtle aversion or fear connected to it, where you'd rather not look at it, and kind of turning away, letting go too easily, kind of pushing away. There could be a way in which you're shutting down part of yourself. You're a little bit numb or shutting down. I don't know. I mean, I'm just making up things here, but it could be some interesting phenomena to look at. And maybe the most interesting time to look at it is when you find yourself, relatively to normal times, calm. And then when you're calm, bring something up to think about. Just intentionally start thinking about something. And get a feel of what it looks like. What does it feel like to think when I'm intentionally thinking about something? And, it could be that you've memorized a poem or a song, and just recite the poem to yourself in your thoughts, thinking, not out loud. And just watch the process of what happens when you kind of recite that in your mind. Or think about something. Think about, what you want to do on Sunday. Plan something, Or think about something that frightens you, really concerns you. And from that calm vantage point, if you intentionally think, maybe then you have a different relationship. You can get a handle on it. Because if you try to use your mindful, if you're trying to meditate or you normally try to look at your thoughts, there's the intentionality kind of falls away too easily. And so the thought thinking falls away maybe. So that's what I recommend. Look at it and study it. And in the corners of that ecological system of thinking, you might look and see how much clarity or lack of clarity is there in the mind. When you're trying to, overall, does it feel foggy, the mind, or does it feel clear? Is there any kind of emotions connected in the corners of this ecosystem that seem connected to this, very subtle, that maybe influences it? What's the energy level like in your system? Is it energized, is it not? What do you think about thoughts? Do you think thoughts are words, or are thoughts for you more images? And so you're trying to connect to words, but really your mind is more image way of thinking. Then maybe you're missing your mind because your mind thinks more in images. There's a lot of possibilities. So hopefully this list of things I've said helps you with your investigation.
When I say an abstraction, one of the things I remember from graduate school is that one of our teachers taught Freud, and she said that he thought there was a primary language and a secondary language, and the primary language was our dream language and our storytelling going on inside, and his theory was that it happened all the time, and then secondary language was discursive thinking. It was more identified with our ego, and I'm only thinking of it now because I never noticed it ever till I started meditating. But when I meditate, I have a lot of discursive thinking, and I let go of it over and over. And it often happens in my 45-minute sit that there's a point at which I notice I feel that this language that she uses really helps. That suddenly. Images start popping up from somewhere deep, and I don't feel identified with them. And they're the same kind of thoughts, but they're from deeper down. I guess I would say they're like dream images, and they're kind of nonsensical. But they're less sticky, and I let go of them easier. And but I'm much more relaxed when they start coming up. I reach a deeper place of relaxation. But I just let go of them and return to the breath as well. But for me, I notice this distinction between different kinds of thoughts.
Yes, that's right. And it's kind of like the surface chatter of the mind. When the surface chatter of the mind can settle down and we get relaxed enough, then other processes that aren't so discursive begin to operating. And it's not uncommon for people to talk about dreamlike experiences in meditation. Images sometimes happen. And it's kind of like the boundaries between the subconscious and the conscious kind of begin softening some. And other things have a chance. Some people report having feeling really creative, Once the discursive thinking, chatter, quiets down, you get kind of calm. People have access to creative ways of thinking, more intuitive ways of being in the world, and ways of feeling things. And there's a lot of things that deeper kind of ways of processing that can be have a chance. It doesn't have a chance when we're always filling the space with our papancha. And now when you're meditating, it's a good sign to have these things happen. You can congratulate yourself. It's you know, things are going well. And generally the advice in meditation practice is don't get interested in all the images that might arise. Just like earlier on you were letting go of thoughts, and now let go of those as well. To go into it, you know, it's like a really good process has gotten you that far. And don't interrupt the process in order to enjoy this. Trust the process and go further even still. So maybe one more. Andrea's been trying. So maybe you can have the mic up front here.
So I'm curious if it's helpful to engage in very, very focused thinking that really requires a lot of discipline, like something intellectually very demanding.
Sudoku. Crossword puzzles.
Something a little bit more, hopefully more meaningful.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
But some kind of a task. I really was thinking more like an intense sutta study or even just literature, but that really engages the mind, that has some value to itself. It's not just entertaining yourself, but something that is really, that challenges you and that some worth come out of it.
I think
now,
so, yeah,
can,
sure.
Can that in itself, because it engages the mind so intensely, that the mind, one, develops discipline, and two, can then actually relax better when you're meditating? Do you know what I mean?
Well, yes. Maybe, this is the latter, but I think that intense thinking about something can be very useful, because sometimes the intensity of it and an absorption in some kind of question or investigation, mental investigation, can allow some deeper, again, processing or consideration or intuition around that issue to operate. It can't if you're just kind of lightly thinking about it. And so I've seen many times in my life that I believe it's only by my intense thinking about something that I've been able to see it, understand it in a new way, have new understanding, new decisions about something. But what's fascinating for me is that the most important decisions in my life that I made in this way, thinking didn't lead me to the solution. What happened was the thinking gave the mind the focus, the energy, the context, the condition for which something deeper to shift. And then there was a deeper knowing, oh, that's what I should do. But I didn't know that, but that shift required the thinking as a preliminary.
So it's because you engage the mind.
Yes.
It's like an anchor. It's like anchoring on the breath. The mind, you give it a structure.
So maybe a little bit, but I think any time the mind is really focused on one thing, different creative functions of the mind come into operation than they do when the mind is scattered and jumping all over. So it doesn't matter what you're doing. I think some degree of focus provides the mind with a different kind of way of operating. But also, I think that you know, the mind processes things when you're not paying attention. So when I was a kid, the first time I noticed this was we went skiing some years when I was growing up, and I noticed that I was a better skier at the beginning of the ski season than had been at the end of the ski season before, the year before. So in other words, during a period of the summer where I didn't ski, during that period I actually improved my skiing, even though I didn't ski. So there's a way in which that my mind's still processing. And so, or people who have intense problems they're trying to solve, and then they find the problem is not solved when they're thinking, it's solved when they're out biking, you know, and they're not thinking about it. So somehow the mind is still processing, but the intensity and the focus and the somehow allows the mind to do its work, you know, in a deeper way than if you just kind of lightly or casually or intermittently think about it. I think you know, intense thinking is a great thing, or you know, really focused thinking about something. It's a wonderful, important, can be an important part of human life. And all this talk today about you know, clearing the mind, just being present for the actual, what's actual, is a very important process, very important for the process of liberation and freedom. And but if you only stayed with a clear mind all the time that didn't have any thoughts in it, just kind of, you wouldn't really be free. To be free is to have flexibility, to have the mind move back and forth between different modes of operation and operate in the mode that's appropriate at a given time. And so there are times when it's appropriate to engage quite intensely with the world of thought. But then you have the freedom to drop it when that's no longer appropriate. And then when it's appropriate to be empty. And when it's not appropriate to be empty, don't be empty. So that's flexibility. So sometimes with Buddhism also, there's a, you mentioned reading sutras. There's sometimes I engage myself on some topic, some text, for example. And it's the intense involvement of that text that kind of allows me to kind of mine or explore, or kind of fill out the riches of what's going on there. And there are other times that the riches of life are found by not thinking. And it's so delicious. And if I had to choose between the riches that come from thinking and the riches that come from not thinking, if I had to choose between one or the other, I would choose not thinking. Or not thinking. No, this elaboration stuff. But so far I haven't chosen. I go freely back and forth, depending on what's needed or what's... So anyway, so I hope that was helpful. I hope I didn't stir up your thinking even more. And I hope it was a little pep talk to encourage you to at least look at what's going on in your thinking and consider maybe there's an alternative. And maybe you can have more stop signs in your mind. Thank you.